Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. First, we'll go to Lebanon to speak with Los Angeles Times Middle East correspondent Borzu Deragahi, who has been reporting on the revolution next door in Syria, where there is a press blackout. With more demonstrations across Syria on Friday, in spite of murderous brutality from the Muhabarat, the secret police, and military intelligence officers, the unarmed Syrian people continue to challenge the callous and corrupt family clan who claim Syria for themselves. Then we will talk about the boom in overseas sales for U.S. arms manufacturers who, faced with proposed defense cuts at home, are gearing up to sell their wares abroad, in spite of recent examples in Tunisia, Egypt, and Bahrain, where some of this lethal hardware ends up being used against the defenseless people. Jeff Abramson, the deputy director of the Arms Control Association, joins us. Then finally, we'll examine the Obama administration's sellout to lobbyists representing the for-profit college and university racketeers who live off your federal dollars that they charge back to unsuspecting students who end up with a worthless education and under a mountain of debt from student loans that, nationwide, now surpass all credit card debt. David Halperin, director of campus progress at the Center for American Progress, joins us. I'm now joined by Borzu Deragahi, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He has won the Overseas Press Club Award and has been twice nominated for the Pulitzer for his coverage of Iraq. His recent articles in the Los Angeles Times have covered the uprisings in Syria and its impact throughout the region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Borzu Deragahi. Are you there, Borzu?
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I hear you.
Obviously, it's extraordinary, the courage of the Syrian people, given what they're facing, the unmitigated brutality of this regime, that every Friday, throughout the country, they still take to the streets and get shot with heavy military hardware. In the north, we know people are being squeezed there and fleeing into Turkey. Just, though, to get a sense of, I mean, in many ways, one would like to know what it is. We know what motivates the people who are risking their lives to free themselves. But what motivates the people who support this regime?
Well, it's complicated. I think it is a minority regime. It is dominated by not only the country's Alawite, which is the sect that Bashar al-Assad and his immediate family belong to, but also other small Shiite sects. And it also has a buy-in from the country's various Christian denominations. And over the past 10 years or so, Bashar al-Assad has managed to woo certain elements of the majority Sunni business community. So I think to some extent what motivates the people who are supporting the regime is fear, terror of what will come after Bashar al-Assad, whether they will lose their status, whether they will lose their lives, whether they'll be subject to revenge attacks. By people who've been the majority, who's been oppressed for so long. This is the dilemma of all minority regimes throughout history. This is the problem they have: is that it's very hard to go through a transition period that doesn't completely disenfranchise them, as was the case, for example, in South Africa, a very traumatic giving up of power by a minority group, and to some extent, that's it. And I think also to a very, very lesser extent, it's an issue, the regime has been successful in convincing some people, as well as certain, Western analysts abroad, let's call them useful idiots, that if Assad goes, the Muslim Brotherhood will take over, and Syria will turn into an extremist Islamic state, which it will not.
Well, you could add to the the useful idiocy by suggesting that a lot of people believe the nonsense that Bashar al-Assad was a reformer, But there was a substantial demonstration the other day with a vast Syrian flag, and clearly there's a lot of patronage, I believe, in the support. But I take it that particularly the Christian minority, they must be looking next door at what happened in Iraq, where the Christians have all but been driven out. We've also, the Copts in Egypt have been met with a certain amount of brutality. They're a little insecure. Is that what's informing people about the possible consequences of the collapse of this regime?
Yeah, I mean, that is a fear. I would argue that, for example, Iraq is a sort of a strange exception in terms of the way the change came about. and the use of the Christians by the extremists as a sort of target. And Egypt, you do have sectarian issues there as well. But in many ways, having been to Syria and Egypt, they're very different countries. There's a much different feel to Syria and Egypt. And, by the way, Hosni Mubarak was not very good at protecting the Christians either in Egypt. Much of the sectarian strife that has happened in Egypt was under his rule.
Well, there were also suggestions that maybe he was covertly sparking those burnings and riots as a way to warn the people in that tactic that Gaddafi and all of them use, you know, if I go, it's all Al-Qaeda. And I take it that's the Syrian regime's message as well. I was going to ask you, though, about what seems to be the key issue here in terms of, there's no question that the young people and that the psychological power of this regime has been broken. The more and more people don't fear them, and particularly the young. And I believe over half the country is under the age of 20. So it seems to me that you could make the calculus that maybe this is inevitable, that this regime will go. But what I think would be where it would crack, surely, would be within the military. And we're learning now more and more that the intelligence officers that are assigned to all the military units are the ones that are killing the soldiers. And if you're a Syrian soldier, you have an incredibly difficult choice between killing your people, your own defenseless fellow citizens, or being killed by Maher Assad's thugs. So do you think that the real crack will happen when the Sunni majority within the ranks break with the Alawite mafia?
Well, I think to some extent that might be happening on a small scale. I think that, for example, one of the reasons why, you know, there's like a huge peaceful demonstration in one city, for example, Hama, on Friday. Meanwhile, you know, just a few miles away in another city, they're crushing people and killing them. It's because basically the Syrian regime doesn't trust many huge swaths of its own military apparatus. And so it is relying on an increasingly thin sort of grouping of units, of 4th Armored Division being one of them, the Presidential Guard being another, to carry out its most sensitive operations. And it is not deploying, you know, Syria has a huge military. It's not deploying the 500,000 soldiers it has on hand because from what we can see, it doesn't trust them.
Well, there's a report in Sunday's New York Times from the Turkish side of the border where there's refugee camps being set up and there's a makeshift communications center. And one of the people that they quoted, of course, these people are concerned about being exposed back home and retribution to their families. But nevertheless, one of the people who was identified as a former cameraman with state television, and he was saying that he couldn't work with the propaganda machine anymore, and that everybody in the country, and particularly the journalists, know that the so-called police that are being murdered are in fact the army soldiers, mostly, who are being killed by Maher al-Assad's intelligence officers. So I guess it's pretty hard to get a sense of how far that's going along. I mean, there was a young officer on Al Jazeera recently who broke with the regime. But would you suggest that's the crack that we should be watching?
You know, it's hard to tell what is happening within the security forces, especially at the higher echelons. But it's apparent that there are some major cracks that are developing. We saw that in Jisr Shagor, where the government itself was forced to admit that there were people in uniform shooting at other people in uniform. They tried to spin it as terrorists who somehow found security officials' uniforms and vehicles. But I think that one of the most sort of One of the most poignant comments that I've heard in recent times was a Western diplomat who's in Syria. He's based in Syria. And he was saying to me, look, this is an ugly regime. Its downfall is very, very ugly, and its ultimate collapse is going to be very, very, very ugly. And I think that regional countries, Western countries as well, and other countries should be bracing for that ultimate collapse. And many people are already starting to see that this is a regime that can't last.
Again, I'm speaking with Bozu Dargahi, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's in Beirut, Lebanon, where there were pro and con demonstrations, I take it, pro-regime, pro-Assad and pro-revolution there. And of course, we know that the country of Lebanon was torn apart by a long civil war. And as I mentioned earlier, Iraq, the sectarian violence that followed the so-called liberation of Iraq by the Bush administration, surely is some kind of an object lesson in how hideous sectarian violence could be. But it seems, though, you reported about the apparent change of heart with the Turkish regime. Prime Minister Erdogan, I take it, feels quite passionate and personal about what's happening there. And he's let his feelings be known. And they've had a lot of trade and good relations with that country. Do you think that they will be a big influence in a post-Assad Syria?
I think that they will be. I think that, it's just very natural for Turkey, especially a Turkey that's, newly looking eastward instead of looking, at Europe as it had been for 80 years, to take a sort of large role in a country that is, has long been a part of its cultural and historic sphere of influence. As part of the Ottoman Empire, it is interesting. It's personal, but it's also political for Erdogan. The sectarian makeup of Syria, the sectarian and ethno-sectarian kind of structure of Syria, where you have Sunnis, various Shiite sects, Christians, and Kurds, is very similar to Turkey's ethno-sectarian makeup, and. People are starting to notice this in many ways, and so you have a situation where the Turkey's Alawites and Alevis are siding with the regime more than the country's Sunni majority, and the Kurds are starting to raise an eyebrow as well. So there's a strategic interest as well as a sort of sentimental attachment to what's happening there.
And Bozu Dargahi, we know that the Assad regime, to some extent, have manipulated the Palestinians. They have a substantial Palestinian population controlled by their Palestinian surrogates, if you will. But most of the analysis over here has been, well, this is just Assad trying to distract us from his problems at home. But it would seem to me that actually it's probably more than that, isn't he? He's really threatening the Israelis by saying I can, because the state television recently said there are 600,000 Palestinians who soon will be telling them to go home. Now, this apparently has resulted in some factional fighting within the Palestinian camps. And I believe Habash, the leader, almost got shot the other day. What do you know about that? Because the assumption would be if Assad can manipulate the Palestinians into these suicide attacks across the Golan Heights, then the Palestinians can't be too smart, which I fail to see that as being a real possibility.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think about the sort of insular and isolated Syrian leadership and the way they think about the world. They have various cards that they play, have the Golan card that they can play. They can have the Palestinian card. They have the refugee card. There's a serious belief on the part of many people that they are creating this refugee crisis in Turkey, as well as a smaller one in Lebanon, and as well as some troubles on the Jordanian border, in order to send messages to the world that they can create a lot of trouble. That if the Syrian regime collapses, it's going to not go quietly into that good night. This issue with the Palestinians, although the Palestinians' cause is legitimate and there is a sort of Arab Spring sentiment in the Palestinian camps and in the occupied territories towards standing up for their rights in the face of the occupation. There is some concern that the Assad regime is sort of manipulating this issue, manipulating the Palestinian factions it controls to stir up trouble and send the world a message. In fact, there was a protest in one of the camps near Damascus where the mothers of some of those people who were killed trying to cross the Golan, cross into the Golan, Israeli-occupied Golan, were protesting against one of the pro-Syrian Palestinian factions, who in turn opened fire and killed even more people, killed like 11 people who were conducting a protest against the pro-Syrian Palestinian PFLP General Command.
And I had heard a report that actually Habash himself had to be taken, escorted out of there because people were so enraged.
People are angry, yeah. They're saying, why are you, you know, manipulating our sons into getting killed for your own cause? Now, there is a little bit of, intra-Palestinian rivalry at work there. Most likely the people who were stirring up this counter-protest were linked to Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction, protesting against some of the more pro-Syrian factions, such as Hamas and PFLP-GC. But still, you know, there is this concern there. There is this worry there, even among the Palestinians themselves.
So just in closing, Bouzidar Aghaei, the British, the French, Portuguese and other Europeans are working on a draft resolution to condemn Syria through the Security Council. So far, that's been any efforts in this regard have been blocked by Russia and China. Given the kind of geopolitical blackmail that you just described that the Assad regime's up to, they're saying to all the neighborhood, we can make life miserable for you. If we go down, we're going to go down and try and drag as many of you down with us. So what's the where's the likelihood of a break there? And it's frankly mystifying. What are the Chinese and the Russians thinking? Is it just that they're on the rejectionist front?
Well, I think, Syria's been a good customer of Russian weapons for many, many decades. So that's something to consider, for the Russians to consider. And they worry that, a post-Assad Syria, perhaps in the Western sphere of influence, will buy their weapons from, like, Turkey and the U.S. instead of from them. I'm sure that's one of the concerns. I think, though, if you parse the language of the Russian diplomats very carefully, they always say that, we will absolutely reject any resolution against Syria that includes the similar language that was in the resolution against Libya. So I think that there's a lot of wiggle room in there. No one wants to launch military action against Syria, anyway. And no one is asking for it, as was the case with Libya. You don't have a transitional Libyan government pleading for help. You don't have the Arab League endorsing it. So I think that actually, I think China will do whatever Russia will do, and I'm fairly certain that Russia will either abstain or vote in favor of a watered-down resolution that excludes the possibility of military action.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles from Beirut, Bouzidar Aghaei.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Bouzidar Aghaei, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the U.S. military-industrial complex is gearing up for record overseas sales of their arms. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Jeff Abramson, who is the Deputy Director of the Arms Control Association, where he's been working to create a robust arms trade treaty. Starting on June the 27th, he'll take up a new position as coordinator of the Control Arms Secretariat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Abramson.
Thanks very much, and happy Father's Day to all of you.
Well, thank you, Jeff. The United States arms manufacturers are expected to sell about $50 billion in military hardware to foreign governments in this year, which is up nearly 50% from last year. So, I suppose it's pretty obvious that even though the defense cuts are promised, $400 billion, the administration is promising. Secretary Gates said he cut $300 billion, but it's really hard to find where that $300 billion was cut, given that there are more weapon systems in the Pentagon after he left than there were when he came. But the long and the short of it is, let's just assume for a moment that there'll be something more than cosmetic cuts in the defense budget here at home. I take it the military industrial complex figures that they got to get out there and sew up some markets.
That's certainly true, and this is the cuts that are being talked about now are certainly not unforeseen. And the defense industry has been looking for a while to see where will our competitive market or our market continue. And obviously overseas sales has been an avenue that historically has been of interest. And certainly if Congress and the U.S. government is willing to try to figure out ways to increase those foreign sales, industry is not going to be opposed to that idea. They are in it in part for the financial side. And if that market out there can be made larger, which is a question, I would say, actually, it is something that is on the table.
Well, we know even some of the progressive politicians, for example, Barbara Boxer supports the continuation of the production of the Boeing C-17, which the Pentagon have been trying to close that down, and Congress has been asking for more planes than the Pentagon want. And it looks like they've lucked out here with India buying 10. I signed that deal on Wednesday. Saudi Arabia's ordered $60 billion in military hardware. Australia wants 24 Seahawk helicopters. So the market's out there. When does the Paris Air Show start? Sometime this week, doesn't it?
The Paris Air Show, I believe, is underway.
It's underway. It just started, yeah. So I imagine they're all out there selling their wares. So what do you attribute to this rise in purchasing of American arms? Is it because the U.S. Has battle-proven weaponry, given all the wars we've been in lately?
Let me put this in a slightly longer historical perspective. There has been, for the last 5 years, so going back actually to the Bush administration, a real increase in the effort to sell and actual countries willing to buy American arms. Whether there is going to be an actual global increase in arms sales is a slightly different question, and the trend is only mildly upward, and there are some expectations for global sales to decline as we look at a global economy that might not be as strong as it used to be. So the news out today is a bit sensationalist, but it's timely because within the United States there hasn't been a lot of conversation about the United States remaining and seeking to be the world's number one arms dealer. And the Obama administration has, in many ways, been working hard to not just continue the trend under the Bush administration, but to ramp it up, partly giving national security reasons, but also partly citing a need for the U.S. to increase its total exports as part of the economy. But what might drive this is hard to tell. In a lot of places, it's the countries that still have money. So you're looking at India, you mentioned earlier, as an economy that's thriving. Brazil is also another one of those that actually has decided not to ramp up this year, but will probably in the coming year. Those are interesting places. And Secretary Gates was recently criticizing NATO for not spending enough on its defenses. So maybe that is also an effort to get, and this has been in the news, to get NATO countries to increase their purchases. So there's many factors going on in this push. Whether the United States is going to see a huge increase, you have fluctuations from year to year, so I'm still waiting to see. But as you mentioned, we did notify Congress of the $60 billion arms deal to Saudi Arabia last year, which is just sort of unprecedented in many ways.
Well, apparently the industry, the contractors, are happy with the Obama administration. Northrop's chief executive, Wesley Bush, in a recent conference in London, said to credit the Obama administration, he said the U.S. has finally started serious attempts to reform the laws and regulations governing our export control. So, what's behind that praise when he says that they're making it easier to sell this stuff abroad, or does that mean they're stopping the penalizing people from bribing? Because the arms sales to Saudi Arabia are all about hidden bribes. I mean, that is the way it works. That's the royals at the very top. That's how they make their money, by hidden kickbacks in these massive arms deals. So what's going on in terms of the Obama administration taking the gloves off, as it will? What have they done? Do you know?
Yeah, no, it is something I'm tracking closely, and it's one thing that's not gotten a lot of attention within the United States. I don't know if it's about bribes. I haven't seen that part. Obviously, the part of the conversation I'm listening to is around the economic and security interests here. This complaint about the U.S. system being old and hard to use has been long going, and there's been efforts to reform the export control system going back many decades, actually. What has actually happened in this administration of Secretary Gates has been, from the Defense Department, which has often been one of the many constituencies within the U.S. government that has said, instead of decontrolling items, we need to keep strong control. Secretary Gates has actually been making an argument that it's better for national security interests if we stop controlling so many things and only focus on the highest technology items. That'll make it better, easier to work with our allies, and it'll make the system move more smoothly. That's one of the pushes that was missing before the Obama administration. Now, for me, I have great concerns about what I'm seeing. I'm really seeing a decontrol agenda on the export control initiative, which means that the United States will make it much easier for things to flow out the door, including things that are still very dangerous but might be older technology. So a generation or two ago of a weapon, or guns, machine guns, that we might want to know where they're going, we might stop paying attention to where they're going out the door. So it's a very dangerous precedent, but it's certainly one that industry is happy to see happen, because it will make, in their minds, things much simpler and faster. I think there's ways the administration could maintain control over what goes out the door and still make the system better for industry.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Abramson, who is currently the deputy director of the Arms Control Association, and we're talking about record arms sales this year for American arms manufacturers and a concerted effort to increase sales as a hedge against possible defense cuts at home. But some of this weaponry, of course, we've seen it end up in being used against defenseless people by the Tunisian regime, who we sold arms to. In Tahrir Square, it was pretty evident that there were U.S. Abrams tanks rolling around. Not that they were turned on the people, but they certainly, military hardware was used against the people in Bahrain. I don't know what's going on in Yemen in terms of whose arms are being used against whom. But clearly, this is something that must put the administration on both sides, opposite sides of the very issue that they're trying to. They're saying they want to support the Arab Spring. So these brave kids in the streets are not going to be too happy if they're. In fact, wasn't it fairly clear in the Egyptian uprising that they were holding up canisters of spent cartridges with "Made in the USA" on them?
All those you're talking about is very good, because it's really actually shocking to me the United States representatives would be now talking about how great their military sales are, given what's happening with the Arab Spring. This is a moment where you would expect a government that was the left hand was talking to the right hand to not be emphasizing the sales, but actually be emphasizing being a responsible actor moving forward. So, you know, the Egypt example was tear gas canisters in Tahrir Square manufactured in the United States, which caught global attention. But the broader Arab Spring itself is a great example of the U.S. had provided weaponry to countries that now we'd like to see a change. Certainly Tunisia and Egypt, but you have Saudi Arabia as one of our major benefactors. Bahrain and Yemen have received assistance. Syria and Libya, not so much. So the United States maybe looks better than some other countries. But for the United States, now is the moment where it should be talking about being a responsible actor. And there have been a couple of administration officials who have said, we're going to look more closely as to what's happening in the Middle East. We'll try to take a case-by-case review. Some things that were in the pipeline have been slowed, but there are no details on what that is. But this moment right now is not one where I would see or expect the United States to be bragging about its sales and upping its sales, but more talking about how do we look at what's happening in the Middle East, how do we look at what's happening in the global community to support a global regime that would say, okay, there is legitimacy in arms sales, but what criteria should we take into account? And places where we can expect human rights abuses, which is part of U.S. law right now but not always followed, we should look more closely and maybe not see arms go to that region. Within the Middle East, what I would have hoped would have happened was that there would be a convening of the major suppliers to look at ways to create a better regime. At the global level, there is this push right now to create an arms trade treaty. I'd be happy to talk about the excitement and hope that would be, because part of the argument you always hear is that if I don't sell it, someone else will, which is part of the reason why you need other countries to also agree that these are the factors that go into a responsible arms trade.
Well, it seems that for the longest time, the Russians and to a lesser extent the Chinese have sewn up the small arms trade because of the ubiquitous AK-47 that's flooding Africa and the Third World, where countless more people die from that than anything else, I think. But, you know, some of the weaponry the U.S. has is pretty lethal, obviously. And the whole point I thought of standing up to Gaddafi was that the world could not sit idly by and watch a dictator use sophisticated military equipment against his own citizens. You know, the Syrian regime are using helicopter gunships against their unarmed demonstrators. So we know that that threshold has been crossed. But what are the likelihood of some of the really seriously damaging U.S. equipment getting into the hands of the wrong people? What's to stop it?
Well, this is where you take the long view and you try to only sell it to places you feel are stable in the first place and that have good systems in place to control the weaponry. This is why you see the countries talking about Libya, whether to arm the rebels or not, because they don't know who those people are, and they don't know whether it makes sense to arm those rebels. And that's why you'll see this issue is one that people recognize. It's not something people haven't thought about. It's true that as soon as you let go of that weapon, even if you have agreements that those aren't going to be moved on, there's a chance that they will be. So you try to very much control who you're selling them to and how they use them, but ultimately you are going to be at their mercy once they own the item. So this is where I think there are examples where the global community really has decided there are places that don't need a ton of weaponry, that it's just not in global interest. You can look at Burma or Myanmar if you want to talk about them, or North Korea, and those are extreme examples. But I'm not without hope that countries do recognize that there are places in the world where it just isn't wise to be developing them in terms of weaponry. There are many other mechanisms from economic development, democracy promotion, that should be on the agenda for countries. And it was actually, in many ways, heartening that as the Libyan example occurred, that the European countries that had been more responsible for arms sales, as well as Russia, decided to cancel those, that they did recognize that these really vast human rights abuses, those regimes shouldn't be rewarded. Now, so, as you mentioned, we're not 100% doing that. We still are supporting regimes that, even by the U.S.'s own standards, aren't meeting human rights goals.
Well, we're just in the last minute Jeff. I just wanted to get to your new job that you're moving to, the coordinator for the Control Arms Secretariat, and you mentioned a global regime. Just in the less than a minute, can you quickly sketch that out?
Sure. At this point, all the countries in the globe are engaged in a conversation that's being sponsored by the UN to set up a legally binding international arms trade treaty that would provide guidance on what are the criteria countries should use when they make arms decisions, what types of weapons should be considered within a treaty, and how would we make that happen so that moving forward, the trade in arms is much more responsible, that the human cost of the arms trade can be reduced, and it'll be a much safer endeavor.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Jeff Ravenson.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Abramson, who is currently Deputy Director of the Arms Control Association, and soon he'll be the coordinator of the Control Arms Secretariat. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the education racket. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is David Halperin, who is the Director of Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress. Campus Progress is devoted to supporting progressive activists and student journalists on college campuses. David Halperin is a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and Howard Dean. He has also worked as an attorney and consultant for such groups as Public Citizen, Greenpeace, and Democracy for America. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian. I'm glad to be on the show.
And it's a startling and alarming statistic to learn that the student debt in the United States is greater than the consumer credit card debt. That seems to me to be a national shame, given that most of the student debt is federal money, that the taxpayers' money that has been given by the government to private entities who then charge students extra for the same federal money that they could get a lot cheaper. And they end up with this saddled with these enormous debts. And we can get into the issue of the quality of the diplomas they get in the meantime. But just to look at this broadly, do you share my outrage?
There's real concern about students taking on debt at all kinds of institutions, whether they're nonprofit colleges, public colleges, or for-profit colleges. The biggest concern right now is about for-profit colleges, which are the most expensive, which often have low-quality programs, which are leaving many, many students deep in debt and often not even able to get a job based on their training. And even if they do get a job, they may not be able to pay back their loans. We're creating a situation where people's lives are being ruined and where potentially we have a bubble, subprime-like bubble situation where there could be serious financial repercussions of the whole thing. So there's a lot to think about here, and there's a lot of reform that's needed.
Well, of course, that's why I'm talking to you. The reform efforts that have been underway, and the Obama administration said that they were going to make some changes because they apparently felt that this was an unfair situation where the taxpayers' money is being essentially given to entities with political connections who are then able to charge this same money back to students and make enormous profits out of it. And in the process, they've created these enormous lobbying organizations. Now, where does this effort stand? Because what we're hearing now is that the Obama administration may well cave into these lobbyists and the restrictions and reform is going to be watered down.
Well, there was a particular rule that was issued a few weeks ago on gainful employment, and that was a rule that said the premise of it is that students shouldn't be able to, we shouldn't be saddling students with such tremendous debt, and the programs that are leaving students so deep in debt shouldn't continue to be eligible for federal grants and federal loans. What happened was the rule was issued, and it was watered down, and it is significantly weaker, and it will be easier for bad programs to survive under this version of the rule. And the administration is saying, it's actually being somewhat candid about this, that they felt that Congress, if they'd had a tougher rule, might have overruled it. Now, the reason that Congress might have overruled it, I would submit, is not on the merits, but because, as you suggest, so much lobbying is going on and campaign contributions are being provided to people who are sympathetic to the cause here. Many of these schools get 90% of their money from federal financial aid. That means they're lobbying to basically harm students and harm taxpayers with money that was provided by students and taxpayers, mostly taxpayers. And so it is a tremendous shame. But my position is that even though the rule is weakened, it still will affect the school's behavior. The schools still have to worry about being in that bottom 5% of programs that will be penalized by the rule. In addition, 11 states, attorneys general in 11 states, have joined together to investigate the fraudulent conduct of for-profit schools. Private actors are suing, And the media, frankly, has done a tremendous job in the last year, because this debate's been going on, uncovering what's been happening with for-profit schools. Also, many organizations such as ours, consumer groups, civil rights groups, educator groups have all joined together to say that we demand accountability on behalf of students and taxpayers. So even though the rule is weakened, I think that this business model, which for many schools has been basically about scamming students and scamming taxpayers, is going to have to end, and schools are going to have to be more responsible and more accountable.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, who is the director of Campus Progress, and we're talking about the Obama administration's efforts to reform a system where federal money is given out to private entities who then loan it back to students, and these private entities have proliferated. I take it one of the biggest ones is a part of the Washington Post company, Kaplan University. And I take
it that is correct.
And that Donald Graham, the chairman, has been lobbying heavily on behalf of this association of these schools. And my further understanding is that the people who are most complaining on the Hill are Republicans, and two-thirds of the monies that these lobbyists give out go to Democrats. So walk us through that.
Well, first of all, Mr. Graham, he's everywhere. When I call a Senate office, he's either coming or going. He's at the White House. He's been here at our offices. He's just everywhere personally lobbying on this. And he's a respected person. People in Washington don't want to believe that he'd be associated with an institution that is behaving irresponsibly. But if you look at it, an article in the New York Times, you can look up New York Times and Kaplan on your Google, and you'll find that Kaplan has behaved in some very bad practices and done some and made the lives of many people worse. And again, doing it with federal money. As far as Republicans versus Democrats, a good number of Democrats, but not by any means a majority of Democrats, voted when there was a vote in the House of Representatives on this issue, voted with the for-profit colleges. And it does have to do, I believe, frankly, not always with the merits. It has to do with building up friendships with those Democrats among for-profit colleges. And I think on the merits, Democrats and Republicans should be looking out for fiscal responsibility, for protecting taxpayers and protecting students, and not wasting money on programs that ruin students' lives. So it's a serious issue that members of Congress are, and it's almost shocking that they would be defending this position. If you look at who's been hired as lobbyists for the for-profit colleges, many, many prominent Democrats have been hired because Democrats are good at lobbying Democrats and telling Democrats that everything's okay, but it's not okay. And lobbying for the for-profit colleges or voting with the for-profit colleges is an abdication of responsibility for people who are supposed to be serious people concerned about public policy that serves the public good.
So when conservatives say, as they often do, particularly when they're running for president, as the Republican candidates are, one of their litanies is to get rid of the Department of Education. And to my mind, if the Department of Education is just giving out money to all these for-profit universities, maybe they should be eliminated. What's the logic to that? If the government's going to subsidize education, why not give it to the really good schools that are out there that are demonstrably good and open them up for students rather than these diploma mills where the kids get substandard education, take on massive loans, which is they're loaning back taxpayer money that's been marked up. You get a better deal from the mafia, for God's sake.
Well, you know, on that point, schools are doing a couple things. They're getting the student loans, which are not ripping off the students in terms of the rate, in terms of the program, yes. But the student loan system was just reformed, so it tends to be helpful to students. But what these schools do is, sometimes even if students are eligible for those loans, they will go ahead and promote instead. They've already promoted their subprime school. Now they're promoting their subprime direct loan from the school at a subprime rate. So taking advantage additionally of the student, they're doing it a second time. We don't want to abolish the Department of Education or federal aid to education, because in this country, your background, your family wealth shouldn't determine whether or where you can go to school. That should be based on merit and working hard and opportunities for strengthening our economy by getting people into the system. So the problem is, though, when you do support programs like this and wasting federal money, and not all programs in for-profit schools are bad. I know of some that are very good, but many of them are bad. The point of these rules is to is to only support the programs that are helping students. But when you do that, it does call into question the whole enterprise. And that's why we're so determined to see that federal aid stop going to programs that are ruining people's lives and instead be focused on programs that are helping students learn, get skills, and strengthen our economy through their economic activity.
So, David Halperin, do you have any idea of how much federal money goes to these for-profit schools?
I do.
Well, tell me, because
I'm increasingly involved in this issue.
Sure. Well,
$40 billion a year in federal grants and loans go to for-profit colleges, which is not to say that $40 billion is wasted, because, as I said, some of the programs are good. But I can also tell you this. For-profit colleges have 10% of United States students who are in college. They get 25% of the federal financial aid, and they are responsible for nearly 50% of the defaults on loans by students. And that's because their prices are high. They're as high as the fanciest private schools, and their quality can be low. And so people go in, spend a lot, and get very little. And we've met these students, and we've seen how their lives get ruined by getting sucked in through deceptive recruiting. Then they get reported to authorities as successful, even though they haven't been placed in a job, so fraudulent reporting. And then high prices and dismal. And you know, the student came here. He was a Navy veteran. We did an event with him up on Capitol Hill. And he said that he didn't think anyone was actually reading his homework. He was getting an A-plus on all his homework at the school ITT Tech. And so he was writing in his homework, is anybody looking at this? If so, you know, call this number or send me an email. No response, because nobody was looking at it. And a lot of these cases, once you're past 4 weeks and they can book you as a student who signed up for the course, all their recruiting of you and all their handholding of you goes away. They hope you'll go away. And they no longer care because they've got the money. And a lot of this is as cynical as that. It's a straight-up swindle. And the people who are doing those should be ashamed, and the people who are defending it here in Washington, D.C., especially people who call themselves progressives and liberals and Democrats, should be ashamed.
Well, this is absolutely outrageous. And it's particularly cruel when you've got these aspirational kids, particularly ones out of the military who've served this country, who want to get an education and who think they're getting an education. And the taxpayer thinks that they're paying for this kind of stuff. But They're actually enriching these people who put up a shingle and God knows what kind of services they provide. Now, I'd like to also know, if you have an answer to this, David, what is the percentage of the federal money, this $40 billion, that goes to these for-profit schools? Because I see them advertising all the time on television. Are they using federal dollars to advertise and suck people in?
Sure, and also to buy advertisements, saying that don't have a rule that will limit college choice. In other words, trying to oppose the gainful employment rule and other efforts to hold them accountable. That's all paid for by you and me. We put up an ad. I've got a young woman on our staff who just made the video, in a couple hours without any expense. And we put up an ad here in D.C. It's actually kind of cheap to buy TV time in the morning on Fox and MSNBC and CNN. We put up our ad, and it kind of knocked them off their feet, I guess, for a second. So they then, the industry or some representative of the industry, started paying people to say that Campus Progress must be being paid for by the Wall Street short seller Steven Eisman. Even though we'd already said we had no connection to him, had no money from him, they said, how else could we be paying for our multimillion-dollar TV ad campaign? Well, they had the multimillion-dollar TV ad campaign. We spent $4,000 to produce and run our ad on TV for 4 weeks. But they engaged in anonymous fake letters to all our partner organizations saying that we must be under the thumb of this Wall Street short seller. They made similar attacks against former government officials from the Department of Education, saying that they must be controlled by the short sellers and behaved improperly. Just these are dirty tricks, again, financed by American taxpayers, because most of the money that for-profit colleges have comes from American taxpayers. So it is, again, one of the most shameful things I've ever seen. Senator Harkin said the most intense lobbying campaign he'd ever seen. Now, of course, you see similar ones from Wall Street, you know, at the Banking Committee and at the Energy and Commerce Committee on oil and gas issues. It's part of an effort now, part of something that young people whom I work with, I'm not young, but our staff is all young and our community is all young, are concerned about, which is increasing dominance of Washington by businesses that don't actually have a legitimate point of view, but that use resources to pump up their message and campaign contributions to gain allegiance by members of Congress. It's a very serious issue. Our democracy is being bought and sold increasingly by increasingly powerful special interests here in Washington. And I've worked here for 25 years. I've worked in government. I respect private enterprise. I respect people who work in business. I know plenty of my friends have started successful businesses, but it's the Washington part. It's the coming here and defending untenable positions such as this one, and sometimes even winning, as you say in Southern California, because they have the money to do it.
Well, David Halperin, the young people that you're talking about that you work with and work for, they were swept up with all the hope for change with Obama. And as you know, a lot of them are disappointed. And certainly only 140 million voted in 2008, only 75 million voted 2 years later in 2010, which has changed the Congress. And we don't know what's going to happen in 2012. But in terms of the people that Obama put into the White House to be advocates for the students that we're talking about today, Cass Sunstein's the guy in charge, right? And it doesn't sound like, I mean, the criticism I'm hearing is that he's rolled over for these lobbyists. He hasn't been tough enough. You're saying that at the end of the day, it's better to have a watered down regulations than none at all because the Congress wouldn't stomach anything stronger. So tell me what kind of a job he's doing, and Sunstein, and in terms of the whole idea of hope and change. And
yes, we don't know where exactly this rule got gutted inside the system. We haven't really tried hard to find out because we do work closely with these folks. Some of them I know are definitely trying to do the right thing. They do face, I don't really think they ever had a progressive Congress to deal with, and that's their position. I think progressives should stand up for what they believe in, fight harder. They shouldn't negotiate with themselves. George Bush always said, don't negotiate with yourself. I think sometimes from this administration they do. They think that's a smarter course. They also don't think it's helpful sometimes when people are to their left saying that they should have been tougher, even though conservatives seem to get benefit from that when they're trying to push conservative policies. They can say, look, I'd love to compromise, but I've got all these crazy people on the right. That's helpful to them. I think on our side, it's good for progressives, both inside and outside government, to stand up for what they believe in and stick to it. In this case, they pushed a compromise, but as I said, it's one piece of a larger puzzle, and I think people should take heart that far more people understand because we had this debate that many for-profit colleges are ripping off students and ripping off taxpayers. And 11 state attorneys general are at work exposing these frauds. Private lawyers are doing it. Journalists are doing it. Our organizations, all kinds of groups from the NAACP and La Raza to Consumers Union, which were not part of this discussion, are now very strongly, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, we're all together saying this is an important issue about education, about fiscal responsibility, about justice, and I think that we will prevail, and I think that the owners of the for-profit colleges out there have to realize that they cannot continue with this reign of impunity and irresponsibility, and that they will be held accountable, and if they can make money, if they change their business model to one that actually helps students learn and succeed in our economy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, David Halperin.
Ian, it's great to be on the show. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, who is the director of Campus Progress at the Center for American Progress, which is devoted to supporting progressive activists and student journalists on college campuses. David Halperin is a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and Howard Dean. He's also worked as an attorney and consultant for such groups as Public Citizen, Greenpeace, and Democracy for America. And I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, Kim Nassiter, and Ian Rowe. I'll be back on Monday at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now.